Ask that you give Brother Johnny your careful and your prayerful attention.
Thank you, Bob. I wonder if I commenced this thing. It says I did. I hope that we were listening closely to the words that we just sang. Five verses full of the wonders that the Lord does for us. And most of them, I think, are the daily wonders that we experience in our life and don't much notice, just kind of accept them as being part of what is due to us, since we are, after all, the children of God. I want to read for you this evening from chapter 9 of the book of Matthew and begin at verse 1. And he entered into a ship. Now, this was just after Jesus had encountered the person who was possessed of an evil spirit, and the evil spirits asked of him that they be sent over to occupy a herd of swine. What difference it made where they went, I don't know. But he did that, and the people of the city came out and said, "Go away, go away." So he did. He entered into a ship and passed over and came into his own city. And behold, they brought him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed. I've often wondered what the palsy was. I finally looked it up a few days ago, and it tells us that it comes to us from an old English word that means paralysis, with or without tremors. So, essentially, this man was paralyzed in whatever members it affected. Makes you wonder if maybe he was a victim of polio or something like that. But he was so afflicted that he was unable to do for himself, and it was necessary that he had to lie on a bed because he couldn't even sit up, apparently. I think we need to realize just how bad off this person really was. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, "Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee." And behold, certain of the scribes said within themselves, "This man blasphemeth." Now, as we read in the Bible, blasphemy generally means, or did mean in those times, to proclaim one to be equal with God. And when he told people that their sins were forgiven, which was many times, or anything like that, why they said he's claiming to be God's equal, and so he's a blasphemer. And they were under the law of Moses. They were to be killed. A good excuse, and they were looking for a good excuse. So he gave it to them. And behold, I'll read this one again. And behold, certain of the scribes said within themselves, "This man blasphemeth." And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, "Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts? For whether is easier, to say, 'Thy sins be forgiven thee,' or to say, 'Arise and walk'? But that ye may know that the Son hath power on earth to forgive sins, then saith he to the sick of the palsy, 'Arise, take up thy bed, and go into thy house.' And he arose and departed to his house. But when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power unto men." The common people saw that it was the work of God and glorified him. The uppity, rich, powerful, all they saw was, we've got to get rid of this guy. I think that we have mentioned among us in our discussions, and we have seen probably in life, those of us who have reached mature years, that when there's a conflict between good and evil, often those on the evil side wish to do violence or even to kill those that are right. We can ascribe it to the devil. I think that's proper. But the ones that are on the right side don't seem to have any ill feeling, or at least not violent ill feelings toward the person that they're trying to reason with. But those that are on the wrong, how they do rise up. And I think that I'd like to go a little deeper into blasphemy, because in my dictionary it says that it is to speak disrespectfully or contemptuously of God or any person or thing that is regarded as an object of worship. Because we're going to come to a place where I believe that's the definition that we'll want. And this we have recorded in chapter 17 of the book of the Revelation. And I want to read a portion of that book, of that chapter, beginning at verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels which had seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither. I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon the many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. This beast with the words of, or the names of blasphemy, I think is the one that speaks disrespectfully or evilly against God. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carried her, which has seven heads and ten horns. And then he went on to tell her of that beast. But he reprimanded John. He said, you've kind of lost your equilibrium here for a moment, because he wondered and marveled. And I'm satisfied that what he was wondering and marveling at was a combination of these many things. First of all, the great wealth that she represented. Her manner of dress and that sort of thing. And also the appearance of power, of great power, which has become so important in the minds of so many people in these days that we are never free from concern about it. And also for the physical beauty. We remember that John was a mortal man. He could be affected by these things, and he couldn't keep from being amazed and even admiring both the wealth and the beauty. I think that it's often the case that when we think of great evil, we're inclined to think also of great physical ugliness. We when we were little kids and we had the little stories, the fairy stories and the fables of the Aesops that always had a good moral at the end and all those, the witches were always ugly and vile looking and dressed in horrible looking costumes and all that. But we know now that there are witches in the world, and some of them are very beautiful and very well appointed in their dress and in their carriage of every sort. And it kind of still sticks in my mind that evil is ugly and looks ugly, but it is not true. And so John, when he was reprimanded and would be brought back to thinking of the things that he was supposed to think, he would realize that this woman was possessed of everything that it would take to appear to be desirable to the carnal man. The wealth, the power, and the physical beauty. And it was just a little more than he could take in his stride. And we must consider the possibility that we can meet up with evil in ways that we can't simply take in stride and say, oh, well, this is what the devil uses. These are the powers that he exerts. Well, of course it's true, but we don't think of that first. Sometimes we can manage to let ourselves get rather deeply shaken, excuse me, deeply shaken before we remember that it's our duty to call upon the Lord for help, because we're not going to be able to resist the power of the devil on our own. And I find that I'm afraid in the beginning of the realization of just how widely the lust for personal power is distributed in the lives of the people of the world. We find people seeking power in every way. I often have to go back and rehearse something that occurred in my days in the powerhouse. And one of them concerned a man that obviously spent a great deal of his time trying to curry favor with the powers that be, because he wanted to be the foreman. He didn't know much about the plant. He didn't really understand what made it go. He knew what we pushed out into the wires on the far end, but how we did it, he didn't know. And it was said by several people to me, I believe that guy, if he could be foreman, he'd be glad to do it without having to have a raise in pay. And at the time, he was on the bottom of the totem pole for pay. Everybody had some seniority and some training, was above him in pay. And I believe it was true. I honestly do believe that he would have been glad to have that authority, and the money would be totally not to be considered very seriously. And our company heard the jealousy over workers' pay. One of the people would tell us how many months and how many dollars it had cost him, because when a certain person would retire, he would go up a step on the ladder and make a little more money. And he knew how much that was. Month by month, he knew how much it was. It staggered my imagination then, and it still does. But this has got to be common among people, or it wouldn't ever have happened there among us. I'm satisfied that is the way it is. The people who spend their days doing their job don't have time to worry about what somebody else might be making or somebody else might be doing or what they might aspire to for title, and how important titles can be to people. If a man rises to judgeship in the courts, he's called judge for the rest of his life. If a man rises to bishop in many churches, he's bishop for as long as he lives. And many other things like that. Because the titles seem to convey with them some authority, some spark of importance, and men seem to crave that importance a great deal. In the parable that Jesus used, that we often call the parable of the vineyard, and this is in Matthew, the 20th chapter, I'll read a portion of that at least. Well, that was scary. I turned one page too many. For the kingdom of heaven, this is verse 1 of chapter 20, Matthew. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And you know the rest of the story. How he went out early in the morning, and the men he found waiting around where they waited around, hoping to be hired, for the day. And he agreed with them for a day's work and a day's pay. And later he went again and again, until finally it was toward evening, and he hired men yet and agreed to pay them the same amount of money. And of course he got a howl from the ones that had been there all day. We've carried the heat of the day. We've done the most of the work. What are you doing here to us? And he said, Friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst not thou agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is and go. Go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? And he likened it to the way it will be, that the last shall be first and the first shall be last, when he's making the comparisons how the Hebrews were the first to receive the gospel, and the time would come when the Gentile would receive them first, and that time has come. But that jealousy sticks in people's minds and sticks in the world. We gather reading the Bible that the amount he named, a penny, however much money that was, and I don't think we know the comparison to today, but it was a day's wage, and normally it called for a day's work. And being the householder, he could vary that if he would. Now, in the Book of Mormon, it gives us also in chapter 8 of Alma the way that they calculated their money values. And they had a number of amounts of money that are difficult to pronounce. And the first one, the least amount that he named, was a day's pay for a laboring man. And from that on up, it was multiples of that day's pay. A good system. Obviously, it was established by very wise men in a time that they were at peace and living in harmony, so that a workman was valued, but he was still paid a workman's compensation. Many years ago, since Brother Leslie Case worked also in the electric industry, we were comparing the pay rates and the way that they were established. And he said, in our company, a journeyman is a journeyman. That is, he's a fully trained and experienced workman. And he said it didn't make any difference if he were a lineman climbing poles, if he were a meter man repairing meters in a shop, if he were a mechanic in the powerhouse. He was a journeyman, and he got the same amount of money. Our company didn't work that well. And they got a lot of flack for it. And eventually they did try to rectify that. But the people who were involved in the negotiations of our contract from time to time said often, well, those vice presidents, when we tell them that our maintenance people need more money, they say they don't make us any money. The operator in the plant makes us the money. And he likely sat at a desk 50 minutes of every hour and didn't have anything to do while we were in the dirt and the grime and the heat and the cold. But of course, those people were not experienced with what was going on. So since our job was to fix the machinery, there were no meters going around and around and around and telling what we were accomplishing. So they used that for an excuse. Well, none of us got very hungry. I didn't get very fat, but I was a little less lean than I am today. And all in all, got along as well as I should have hoped for and have felt very often. This is part of my testimony that the Lord did lead me here, did lead me to that place to seek work, and there were a few others that some of them people of possibly secure people in their own religion who were every bit as worthy as I was of having something good done for them. And we hired on when that plant was being built. and worked most of its life. And of course, we know now that it's gone and you can't even tell it was ever there. It's as though it was built for those of us that the Lord was willing to do a great favor for. That's the way I feel about it. And when that favor was done, it had no further function, because they could excuse tearing it down because of tax advantages chiefly. That's kind of a side issue, and I've had a little difficulty digressing in putting together these thoughts, because I run possibly too much to the human conflicts that I've encountered. But the struggle in the world from day one, I think we can call it day one, when Satan tempted Eve, up to and including today, is a massive struggle of evil trying endlessly to gain the upper hand over good. And with many individuals, they've won. Remember that the Lord said, "Many there be that go in at that wide and easy gate that leads to perdition, and few that that are worthy of the reward of living in His heavenly kingdom." We are outnumbered. We are greatly outnumbered, but we also need to remember what Elisha. It was that told his handyman, "Those with us are greater, are more than those that are with them." Because we have the difference in our help from God. There's a story that was told widely during World War I. I have no reason to doubt that it was true. And that was that the British were trying to overthrow the Turkish troops who were in command of Jerusalem. They were very grievously outnumbered, and they knew that they had to try their best to overthrow that force of the Turks. And so they did the best they could to divide their men up properly and set their priorities of who will go where when. And when they attacked, the Turks turned and ran. And one of the prisoners was questioned by one of the English officers who was interrogating prisoners, and he said, "Why did you run?" And the Turk said, "Didn't you see all of those people in the white robes?" No, they hadn't. Because those of us, those that are with us, are more than those that are with them. And that time, the General Allenby gave the credit to God, having sent his angels to deliver them. I'm positive that it was true. And as this struggle goes on and on, though, I want to read to you from the Book of Mormon about a man named Sherem. And this is in the Book of Jacob, chapter 5. It's chapter 5, if I can read my hieroglyphics there. Page 190. And I'm going to read it, verse 1. "And now it came to pass that after some years had passed away, there came a man among the people of Nephi, whose name was Sherem. And it came to pass that he began to preach among the people and to declare unto them that there should be no Christ. And he preached many things which were flattering unto the people, and this he did that he might overthrow the doctrine of Christ. And now this, we understand, was a good long time before the Lord visited them. But the teaching of Christ was from their beginnings as a nation. And he, knowing that I, Jacob, had faith in Christ, which should come, excuse me, wherefore he sought much opportunity that he might come unto me. And he was learned, that he had a perfect knowledge of the language of the people. Wherefore he could use much flattery and much power of speech according to the power of the devil. And he had hope to shake me from the faith, notwithstanding the many revelations and the many things which I had seen concerning these things, for I truly had seen angels, and they had ministered unto me. And also I had heard the voice of the Lord speaking unto me in very word from time to time, wherefore I could not be shaken. And it came to pass that he came unto me on this wise, and on this wise he did speak unto me, saying, Brother Jacob, I have sought much opportunity that I might speak unto you, for I have heard and also know that thou goest about much preaching that which ye call the gospel or the doctrine of Christ. And ye have led away much of this people, that they pervert the right way of God, and keep not the law of Moses, which is the right way, and convert the law of Moses into the worship of a being which ye say shall come many hundred years since, hence. And now, behold, I sure am declaring unto you that this is blasphemy. For no man knoweth of such things, for he cannot tell of things to come. And after this manner did Sherem contend against me. But behold, the Lord God poured in his spirit into my soul, insomuch that I did confound him in all his words. And so Jacob was able to reason with this man to the degree that he was not able to shake his faith. And it finally came with his demanding a sign from God, that a sign was given. And it said he was stricken. And that's really all we know. What he was struck down, that he couldn't stand, and that he was nourished for many days, saw that he was going to die, so he requested that the people gather together, and he confessed there before them and died. Well, there were numerous others that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon, and that's about their story. We often refer to the story of Korihor that's in Alma chapter 16, that he did approximately the very same thing, and that he was highly successful among the Nephites that were in the land of Zarahemla. Then he went over into the land of Jershon, and there the people were called Ammonites because they took upon them the name of Ammon, who was the man who had brought the gospel to them. And they had been heathenish Lamanites, and now they were believers and followers of the Lord. Well, he didn't have any success with them. They banished him from their country. And he went from there to the land of Gideon, and they took him and bound him and sent him back to Zarahemla, to Alma, who was the chief priest and also the chief judge in their civil system. And there he went on and on with this very same type of argument as Sherem had used, until demanding a sign. Finally, Alma said to him words to the effect that this is not according to my will, but if the Lord wills it, you will be struck dumb. And he was. And then he confessed. He said, I knew better than this. But the devil is so persuasive, and I wanted it to be this way. And when we think of this on our own terms of our lives, we have observed people who wanted so much for something that they knew was not true, but they wanted it so earnestly to be true that they persuaded themselves that it was true. And he did this. And when he was struck dumb then, he requested that in his confession that he be restored and able to speak. And Alma said, no, if you were to receive your speech back, you'd go back to your old crimes. And we can't let that happen. Well, Corey Hoare had to go about to beg for food, and he was among a group of people who were not what we would call Christian people, and a mob of them ran him down, and he died. And there's a lesson for us in his death, and now I want to try to find that for you so that you see. What it concludes concerning those that the devil manages to use for his own purposes, because it's pertinent to our day, just as it was to their day, and I think that I'm closing in on it here. Chapter 16 of Alma, this is page 416. And I'm going to read beginning at verse 75. And Corey Hoare did go about from house to house begging for food for his support. And it came to pass that as he went forth among the people, yea, among the people which had separated themselves from the Nephites and called themselves Zoramites, being led by a man whose name was Zoram, and as he went forth amongst them, behold, he was run upon and trodden down, even until he died. And thus we see the end of him that perverteth the way of the Lord. And thus we see, and this is the important part, we see that the devil will not support his children at the last day, but doth speedily drag them down to hell. You know, it's impossible for us to visualize, I think, that someone who has gained power over other people would not feel any responsibility toward them, whatever. But the devil has a mind much darker than ours, and he doesn't stick up for his own. As soon as they're worth no more to him, he's ready to dispose of them any way that he can. And if it's to let somebody else kill them, it's fine with him. We need to have that view of him, because as we hear of him accusing the teachers of good, of holding their people in the bondage of fear, a fear of an ogre of a god, and this is not uncommon in the world today, that many people are afraid of God. Terrorized by him, feel that he really doesn't want you to do well, and he doesn't want to have to reward you with good. It's a perverted notion, but it's popular. It works. I've encountered it. But we have this assurance that the devil is not going to be of any assistance to those he has used as soon as they're worth nothing to him. And we have these accounts. We know them well. We use them to illustrate sermons, we use them in our studies, and they're precious to us because of the value of them. And so we see that they rose and fell time and time again. Times of humility and righteousness and prosperity interspersed with times of pride and wickedness that always brings a downfall. And those people did it, and this is the story of the world, though we don't have access to the story of the world to that degree. And it went on until the wicked people in the American continent were destroyed in the storms and the earthquakes and those things that occurred at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus. And so it brought on for those people a time of peace and of rest. But in the world, it wasn't so. And it has gone on until now. And we're struggling now as a world with a question that I think is a matter that the devil uses as a smokescreen to get people's minds off of the things that are really vital in their nations, so that we're terrified of something called global warming. There is history, written history. There's history passed down from generation to generation, oral history. There's the history that's recorded in the sediment and in the tree rings and all those things that men have the expertise to deal with and to read, that tells us that there have been hot periods and cold periods on the earth as long as the earth has existed. And they had a very serious cold length of time during the 19th century. And they also had a very warm time in that century. I remember a year here when our children were small enough that we took them swimming once in a while. One summer that we never took them because it was never warm enough. I never parked my long sleeve shirts that summer because it was chilly all summer. I think an indication of the things that can be, though that didn't continue. But the idea that people would convince themselves that they can do something about the weather is just chilling to me. It's pride, I think, in every respect. It's an overabundance of pride that's frightening to think about, because people are thinking of themselves as being somewhere near to an equality with God, a sin of blasphemy. And I'm satisfied that the Lord knows what he's doing. And I believe that the contrary weather that the world is experiencing, all of the world experiencing some sort of contrary weather these years, that it would stop if the bulk of the people got down on their knees and petitioned God for the help that we need. I'm sure of that, and I think that you generally accept the idea too, that we have been warned and warned again that we need to be humble followers of God and not to give way to this lust for power, for the admiration of other people, because that comes in with that as well. And being thought up as very wise and very good, oh, when those who promote those theories with the greatest vigor, I don't think are wise. And I believe that I can prove that they're not very good. So it's the same old struggle. evil trying all the time to destroy good, to bring good into disrepute so that people won't respect the good. Many times, most of us who have reached mature years have been in conversations with people who are not so much inclined to go to church every week. And they say, "You go to church, don't you?" "Yes." "Well, what do you think of this?" "Or what do you think of that?" Like one man, when more popular of the TV evangelists several of them come to grief for their misbehavior in their office. And he said to me, "Do you think this man that's claiming to perform all these miracles is a man of God?" And I said, "I'll answer you with a question. Does he ask for money?" "Oh, yes, you bet he does." I said, "Did you ever hear Jesus asking for money?" "Well, no." I said, "There's your answer. No, I certainly don't think he's a man of God. I think he's one of those," and I didn't go on with this, but I did. I think, thought then and I think now, that he was one of those that was trying to bring good into disrepute. Sometimes it looks almost hopeless. We feel just like the servant of Elisha. We feel like we're surrounded and overwhelmed. And how can we resist? What can we do to resist? It'll come to its own end. Its own end when it will be when God puts a stop to it for the sake of those who are his own. And while we're doing our best to show a good example of life before everyone that is around us, we also owe ourselves the consideration of much earnest prayer and supplication to God that we be found those who are worthy to be called his own.